Jonathan Trapp is an FAA certified pilot with a specific rating for lighter than air free balloons. His first was a Cameron M34 called Cloudhopper. And balloonists do name all of their balloons. Trapp has made a name for himself for his work with free balloons or those filled with gas other than air. In addition, Trapp has completed specific gas balloon training and has flown under multiple lighter than air gases. He recently flew across the English Channel, up to nearly 18,000 feet was another flight, and has set records for distance and duration in gas balloons. Please welcome Jonathan Trapp.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Great pleasure to be here. Oshkosh, it's outstanding.
So did you try to fly this morning, or how were the winds?
No, the winds for this morning would be fine, but here at the air show, we want to share our joy of flight, and if I launched at 6 o'clock, we'd miss most of the group. So the plan is, if the forecast delivers what it's promising, is to launch today, this afternoon.
Okay. And it is challenging. I've participated in ballooning. I'm not a pilot, but I participated in it. And you got to have the right wind conditions. It's probably the chief consideration.
That's absolutely true. Winds are critical for us during inflation. And with gas ballooning, it's interesting. You have to open up the window of what you're looking at. With our hot air balloons, we fly for maybe an hour. Our gas balloons, we can fly for 3, 10, 15 hours. So we're not concerned about just winds at inflation, but winds aloft, direction, trajectories, and storm cells hundreds of miles away. Because by the time we land, they may be to where we are.
Ever since Larry Walters made a free balloon flight in 1982, people have been fascinated by the thought of floating underneath a bunch of balloons. You know, maybe they go to the store and buy a bunch of birthday balloons. And they think about, if I had enough of these, maybe I'd float away. Was this balloon flight by Larry Walters the first free balloon flight?
Larry flew July 2nd, 1982, and he is not the first to go aloft this fashion. 1937, Dr. Jean Piccard did a much longer flight up to 11,000 feet under a two-tiered hydrogen-filled cluster balloon system. So the history of the sport goes back to 1937, and Larry Walters flew once and only once, but he's the one that catches in people's mind.
You started with hot air ballooning because we mentioned the Cameron early on, and there are several manufacturers of that. Is there a similar number of ground crew needed for a free balloon flight?
When we say, so free balloon could be, there's hot air balloons, it's a manned free balloon, that's fine. It just means free balloon means not tethered to the surface.
Okay.
So when we're talking about the gas cluster balloons, it takes a lot more crew than our hot air balloon. We set up a hot air balloon with 1, 2, 3 people, depending on the day. The cluster system, because there's so many individual cells, we take perhaps 15 people to help us stand the aircraft. And then because we have duration and distance capabilities, potentially flying through the night, we have Chase that will follow us through the night on the ground to recover the next morning. So a larger team helping us here at Oshkosh, and they'll be over there today, and then dedicated team who will be up all night potentially chasing the flight for recovery tomorrow.
Do you still need volunteers?
I believe the EAA, Hal, has taken care of that for us. So I think we have a full contingent of volunteers.
But you do need people to watch.
We would love to have people come over and check it out. We're going to start at about 3 o'clock. It's over. Have you seen the Pixar film Up?
I have not, but a lot of people have, and they love that film.
It is a delightful movie. So in that film, there's a large airship in it, and there's a cluster balloon system. And Oshkosh is unique and interesting in that it brings together a lot of different things. In this instance, we're bringing together the airship, which is over there, the Goodyear blimp, and our cluster balloon system. So we'll do our best to reenact a bit of that film. And they get to be the bad guys in the airship, and I get to be the good guy in the cluster balloon system.
So it's a lighter-than-air legion is going on over there.
That's exactly right, yes. our own contingent, lighter-than-air land, previously known as Kidventure.
You've worked extensively with the FAA, and you were issued an airworthiness certificate for your cluster systems 878 UP, or Uniform PAPA. Some of the safety equipment includes two-way aircraft radios, altitude encoding transponder, breathing oxygen, a parachute, GPS, emergency locator balloon, beacon. I've been in hot air balloons, and I've chased them. It seems like there's a lot more equipment on board your cluster balloon system.
There doesn't need to be. It depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to do a hot air style hop, and fly for an hour and set it down, you could be equipped with what you have for a hot air balloon. But we've been working to take these farther. We've been flying internationally, overnight, long distance, long duration flights, something that, you know, when we flew the Spirit cluster, named after the Spirit of Aviation, a couple months ago, it was the first flight since that first one in 1937 to go overnight. Nobody had gone overnight. So part of that equipment is because we are taking this further. We have longer duration, longer distance, and potentially could land in remote areas. Potentially. We've got capabilities coming out of Oshkosh. Winds out of the south could easily send us to fairly remote areas in Canada. Now, with the trajectories we have, that's not at all the direction we're headed today. Winds are more out of the west-northwest. But when planning for the flight, you don't know, you know, when you're planning months in advance, you don't know what the winds are going to be on the day. So you prepare exhaustively for it so that whatever comes, you have the equipment and training needed to make a safe flight.
Now, we're going to talk about that overnight flight in just a moment because it is really interesting. But first of all, why cluster balloons?
Why cluster balloons? Well, there's that kind of fantasy of flight, and it crosses cultures and crosses borders. I mean, almost everybody at one point thought, as children, they're playing with a balloon and thought, if I could just get enough of these, couldn't I float off into space? And we're told, no, that's impractical. Well, actually, what we're told is that it's impossible. It is impractical. I agree, it is impractical, but it's not impossible. So it's a dream that a lot of us had, our first dream of flight. And we're just combining our passion for flight, our passion for lighter-than-air flight, dream form of flight to create these gas cluster systems.
When did you first start dreaming about flight?
It's kind of like you did, you know, and it's probably with a system. I mean, that was my first dream of flight, you know, just playing with a toy balloon. Now, I don't have that specific memory. It's not like I'm 3 years old and I remember so clearly playing with this balloon and wanted to fly it. But I know I had that thought, and I know I looked at a giant cluster to understand if it could lift me. And I was told that no, it can't. And we've demonstrated that it certainly can be flown, and not only flown in manned flight, but controllably as a certificated aircraft by certificated pilots flying safely and legally.
So take us through the preparation for a cluster balloon flight from the time that you get up in the morning and start looking at the weather.
Okay, so if we started by getting up in the morning and looking at the weather, we're way behind because we needed to be looking at weather a long time ago. So we've been looking at, you know, starting with just looking where we are, airspace constraints, because we don't steer in a conventional sense. So if you have a restricted airspace in front of you, fixed wing or rotorcraft, you just turn away from it. If we're flying with the wind, we will move through that airspace. So we have to be familiar. So we start many weeks in advance of the flight, studying the airspace, studying the topography, because I'm going to land this system bodily. You know, my feet will touch the surface, so I need to understand things like what crops are in. I can land in beans, I can land in hay, I can't land in corn. You know, it's the type of the topography. We have Lake Winnebago, then a bit of dry land, then Lake Michigan in front of us. We don't want to get becalmed over Lake Winnebago or becalmed stuck over Lake Michigan. So those are things we start looking at weeks in advance. Then days leading into the flight, we're watching the progressives, the prog charts, seeing what generally is happening in the weather systems. Then we focus it in and focus it in. So by today, when I woke up today, I re-scrubbed the weather data. That is, I redid what we did last night, ran the trajectories again, looked at, starting at the 10,000-foot view or, you know, whatever, looking at the national view and zooming in. So scrubbed weather this morning. And now we go over to the airfield, which is mostly set up. The lighter-than-air gas is sitting there, ready to be released from these ugly steel cylinders into the glorious balloons. That'll take a couple hours rigging the field, a couple more hours, about 3 hours, inflating the balloons, assembling the cluster. We build the aircraft on the airfield and tear it down after each flight. So that's what we have in front of us this afternoon, building the aircraft in, if the forecast delivers as promised, entering into free flight.
So if you were to head east, say toward Lake Michigan, have you commandeered the high-speed ferry to get your chase crew across if you had it cross there?
You almost say that like you're joking, and absolutely we have. We haven't commandeered it, but the ferry leaves at 1 o'clock in the morning, so it's a 4-hour crossing. If I'm crossing the lake, my crew may well take the chase vehicle onto the ferry and cross the water, arriving in Michigan at 5 o'clock in the morning. Sunrise is shortly after, so it's altogether possible, if I elect to stay up overnight, that I will be crossing Lake Michigan. Now, trajectories with winds out of the northwest, it's not likely that I'll cross in a direction that's useful for the ferry, so it's more likely the crew will drop down to Chicago than hook around, but it's altogether possible, depending on how we elect to fly the system, that we could make an overnight attempt, cross Winnebago, cross Michigan, and put down on the far side of both of those bodies of water. And no, by the way, nobody's ever crossed a body of water as extensive as Lake Michigan in a cluster balloon system.
Now, we will talk a little bit about a body of water you crossed recently as well. As you say, not as extensive as Lake Michigan. So then you study the winds and where it's going to take you. A hot air balloon does descend, rise and descend to take the different wind currents. What about your cluster system?
That's exactly right. Any balloon system, the way you steer it is there are invisible currents of wind at different altitudes. So the way you steer a balloon system is by climbing or descending to select the most favorable winds. That's exactly how we fly our gas cluster. We ascend and descend. We control those ascents and descents either by releasing helium balloons or by releasing ballast to choose the level we want to fly at for most favorable winds. So just like a hot air balloon climbs and descends to take advantage of the most favorable winds, it's exactly how I fly my system. And we float with the wind. We move with the wind. And it's a tremendously peaceful form of flight. Even if you're moving 50 miles an hour, there's no sensation of movement. There is no relative wind. So it is the flight.
Like floating down a river?
Well, even floating with a river, you're jostled around a little bit more. I suppose a very, very peaceful river, very calm, you know, tubing in calm waters. It might be like that, but it's more serene. You're in the open air. You feel it on your skin and you feel it in your lungs. And the flight experience is like the dream form of flight. Like when you're asleep and dreaming of flight, that's the flight experience we have with our gas clusters.
We're live at the Welcome Center here at AirVenture 2010. My guest is Jonathan Trapp, who is a cluster balloonist. He flies 878 Uniform Papa and will be trying to make a flight today and maybe one or two flights later this week. You set a record for an overnight flight earlier this spring. Tell me about the quiet of the night.
Yeah, so we did. This is the flight of the Spirit cluster, and it's the first gas cluster system to launch in the daytime and survive the night and greet the sun from the sky the following morning. So we launched that system in North Carolina, and like you say, the quiet of the flight. First, we went over a Class C airport, so we're talking with the controllers. After we departed that area, I had depleted the battery for my crew radio. And it's now the silent of the night. There's no prop, there's no rotor, there's no jet, and there's nothing interrupting that pure form of flight. And it's now the dark of the night. The temperature drops. I'm aloft. It drops to freezing. And there's many hours of that completely silent, completely dark form of flight. And it was very interesting. I think you're expecting to hear something upbeat about that flight. And it was a very interesting accomplishment. It was also very introspective, that time of complete silence, aloft, thousands of feet in the air, and very cold. It was an uncommon experience. And then, you know, we waited for the sun, that experience of waiting for the sun. And my ground crew, I don't know, I depleted my battery. I don't know where they are, if they're below me. And I know they don't know if I'm okay. And we waited for the sun, and finally I see it's the horizon start to light, and in fact that was the moonrise. We had no moon until closer to dawn. The moon lit the horizon briefly, then we greeted the sun from the sky, started warming, finally the return of the warmth allowed me to initiate a descent now that the sun is in the sky and put it down. And my crew, in fact, had been there throughout the entire night. They were right there at landing. As I was coming in for the landing, they were with the aircraft within 1 minute. So they had been there throughout the night. And it was very substantial to prove that this system can survive nighttime cooling. We weren't trying to set a record. That flight did set a record, in fact. But we were trying to demonstrate the capabilities of the aircraft to survive nighttime cooling, to fly through the night.
And so you're researching the effect of temperature on the gas and how much lift. or degradation of lift it has with the change in temperature. Now, I just wanted to kind of clarify, you said in order to descend, you have to release a balloon. How many balloons can you release?
Well, it depends on the flight input that you want and how quickly you want to be coming down. In fact, on that entire flight, I released one balloon right up and through landing. And then at landing, I cut away a couple cells because I got a sharp climb going up to 7,500 feet. Cut one balloon. That brought me back down to the surface. I released ballast. I got a climb going. The sun set. And I didn't touch another balloon for hours until the following dawn. Cut away a balloon to get coming down. So on that flight, really, there were two that were cut away in flight. And then one more for landing and one more after landing. So that flight, I used a total of four cells. On other flights, I've used that much in the first hour, just depending on what we're trying to do.
Then you made a crossing of the English Channel. What kind of paperwork is involved with that?
Yeah, there was substantial documentation required. So what the language we use is we fly safely and legally. That legally component can be very challenging, even though the aircraft we know flies. You know, it's capable. We know what it's capable of. Meeting the regulations, the paperwork requirements, can sometimes be daunting. So we visited France and asked them what they would need, and the French were pretty laissez-faire about it. They said, okay, you're fine. They were not very stringent. The UKCAA was much more stringent. They said, no, you cannot fly. You cannot fly. You are sub-ICAO. They argued my aircraft did not meet ICAO standards. They said, you're sub-ICAO. Your aircraft cannot fly here. You would need a special exemption to fly here. And I said, can I have an exemption? And they said, okay. And they issued me the paperwork to fly it. So we had participation from our US FAA and the civil aviation authorities in the United Kingdom and France, permission from those two authorities to fly internationally over that storied body of water.
Why don't you quickly talk about, for the people who are listening who are on site, when can they see you fly in the next couple days?
Okay, so today, okay, we are flying today if the weather holds. We'll start inflation over at Kid Venture, Pioneer Airport, where the Goodyear blimp is, where the helicopters are landing. We're going to start inflation at about 3 p.m. We're going to do one more weather check, provided that is what we've seen last night and this morning. We'll start inflation at 3 p.m. takes a couple hours, and looking to launch around 6 p.m. this evening. So either come join us over by where the helicopters are landing at Kid Venture, Pioneer Airport, the Air Academy Lodge. I'll be the guy with the 50-foot towering cluster of balloons. Or about 6:15, 6:30, look up wherever you are on the airfield and see if you don't see our aircraft floating overhead.
Well, we hope that we see you fly today. Thanks very much, Jonathan, for joining us.
It's a great pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Jonathan Trapp is a cluster balloonist. For Steve Buss, I'm Fareed Guillot. This has been EAA Radio Live.